This tape you're about to hear, I have titled Remembering, as it brings for your listening some pertinent facts concerning the life of Hiram R. Cannon, Jr. After giving a bit of information about his family, talking in the third person, there will be an attempt to relate some of the important happenings from the very first items in the little boy's memory until the early part of the 1980s. These happenings will be related in the first person. On Sunday morning, on the 11th of November, 1906, at approximately 8 a.m., Hiram R. Cannon and his wife, Martha Estelle Cannon, she was called Essie by her family and friends, and their two daughters, Frankie Estelle and Ruth Eliza, and the nurse of the two girls, a negress named Harriet Cannon, called Aunt Harriet by all the family. Aunt Harriet was a daughter of one of a group of slaves who were owned by the father of Hiram R. Cannon. His name, Horace Wiley Cannon. He bundled into a two-seated carriage for a drive of about 18 miles from their home in Tallulah Falls, Georgia, to the paternal home of Mrs. Cannon in Clarksville, Georgia. The purpose of the trip, Mrs. Cannon was pregnant and her time for delivery was close at hand. Her two girls were born in the home of her father and mother, and she had requested her husband to take her home for the delivery of this third child. Mr. and Mrs. Alexander Hamilton Church lived on Main Street in Clarksville, Georgia, in a big old rambling frame house set on about 5 acres of land. Mr. Church was a small man, about 5 feet 6 inches tall, and weighed about 155 pounds. Mrs. Church was slightly larger and slightly taller, but her most outstanding characteristic was the size of her heart. She talked with a slight brogue, her maiden name was McAfee, and she had about as much blarney as a combination of Scotch blood and Irish blood can give a person. Mr. Church was the owner and publisher of the newspaper, the only one in Habersham County. It was published weekly. As the Cannon family started out to Clarksville, all bundled up on this crisp November morning, they waved joyously to their older children who were left behind. Their home in Tallulah Falls was a monstrous two-story house which was formerly an inn for summer visitors, but had been purchased and remodeled by Mr. Cannon to house his growing family. Left at home on this day were his 7 children by a former marriage. Their mother had died several years earlier, leaving the 7 children to be raised by Mr. Cannon. 4 boys and 3 girls. The oldest, Cecil, and the youngest, Ethel. Cecil was 21 and Ethel was 4. The other children were Bessie, Blanche, William Harrison, David, and Percy. The second oldest was Bessie, who was 19, and did a lot of mothering until Mr. Cannon remarried Essie Church. The Churches were expecting the Cannons and had prepared places for all to stay the night or more, with the exception of Mr. Cannon. He returned later that day to Tallulah Falls. His business was mercantile and summer hotels. At this particular time, he was building a large hotel for the visitors which had contracted for accommodations for the summer of 1907. The week of November the 11th passed without any activity, but on the following Monday, November 19th, about 7 a.m., a phone call was made to Dr. John Burns and to Mr. Cannon that things were about to happen. Dr. Burns, who lived in Clarksville, got there about 8:30 a.m., but left to come back later. False alarm. Mr. Cannon arrived from Tallulah Falls about 12 noon. Dr. Burns arrived back at around 2:30 p.m., and along about 5 p.m., an 8-pound boy arrived on the scene. This boy was christened Hiram Raleigh Cannon, Jr. by the local Methodist minister at 11 a.m. on Wednesday, the 21st day of November. The boy was returned to Tallulah Falls the 2nd of December and thrown into an array of attentiveness. We will now pick up this story when Hiram R. Cannon Jr. was 4 years old, as this is a time when he has his first recollection. In 1910, Mr. Cannon purchased an inn in Clayton, Georgia, and turned it over to Mrs. Cannon to operate. The older children had married and moved away from home, so the only two of the first family to move to Clayton, Georgia, with the last three children, were Ethel and David. Ethel was 8 years old at that time, and David was 10. In those days, this part of North Georgia was fortunate enough to have a railroad to serve most of the little towns, from Cornelia, Georgia, to Franklin, North Carolina. Cornelia, Georgia, the home of the Big Red Apple, was situated on the main line of the Southern Railroad and one could transfer from the Southern to the Tallulah Falls Railroad. This part of Georgia was also served by freight trains. The train stopped in Clayton, Georgia for lunch, and all passengers stopped for lunch at the Blue Ridge Hotel. This was the inn operated by my mother. The hotel was occupied during the week by what was then known as drummers, road salesmen or traveling men and women, so to speak. These salesmen would call on stores and barns and farmers to sell their wares. My earliest recollection in life had to do with buying some candy. Remember now, I had just passed my fourth birthday, but I still remember the event like it was yesterday. In the hotel lobby was a large fireplace which acted as heat for that area. It was a fairly big room with lots of chairs and some tables for the guests to play cards. The fireplace was 8 feet long and was always in use from October 1st through the entire winter. I remember that I went into the lobby to ask my mother if I could stay out and play a little longer. It was late in the afternoon, and we usually ate supper at 5:30 and went to bed about 7:30. She told me yes, but when she said that, one of the guests gave me 2 pennies and told me to go buy some candy. Mother told me to be sure and come back and offer the guests some of my candy. I went to my cousin Henry's store and bought the candy. Believe it or not, you could get 5 sticks of candy for a penny back in those days, so you see I had 10 pieces of candy for my 2 pennies. I ran back to the hotel and did as my mother had asked me to do. That is, I passed the bag around to the guests. As I passed it around, each person took a stick, until when I looked in the bag, I only had 2 sticks left. Suddenly, I ran out of the lobby and ran behind the hotel and hid under the building. I must have been crying because the hotel cook, George Ramsey, came under the house and picked me up and asked me what was the matter. I must have told him that the men took all of my candy and I was afraid they were going to take my last 2 pieces. Well, later on in life, my mother told me that the men did that to tease me and that they gave her the candy back for her to return to me later on. What a strange thing to be the first thing to remember in your whole life. The first switching that I can remember, and I must have gotten many before this particular one, came about when I climbed a tree that my mother had expressly forbidden me to stay away from. Adjoining the Blue Ridge Hotel was a vacant lot on which there had been planted flowers and a few fig trees. The porch to the hotel was a very long one, and on it were chairs where people used to sit and visit or just relax and gossip in the afternoon. This lot next door was fenced off in front by a white picket fence, and if you were sitting on the porch, you could not see the trees and flowers as they were too far back of the fence. I suppose that Mother had 2 reasons for wanting me to keep away from a tree. First, she thought I would fall and break my neck. And second, she used the figs to make her special fig preserves. Anyway, I slipped around the back of the hotel, entered the lot area where the trees were, and quietly slipped up to the front tree and proceeded to climb to the area where I could reach the figs. They were awfully ripe at that time. I was enjoying them when a lady, the wife of the town dentist, came by and stopped and looked up in the tree and said, "Hello there, Sunny Moon." That was my nickname when I lived in Clayton. My mother happened to be sitting at the end of the porch and heard Mrs. McJunkin speaking to me. Mother stepped off the porch and peeped around the corner and saw me in the tree. Well, that was truly lights out for me as she called me to get down and met me at the front fence and lifted me over and took me to the room which I and my sisters occupied in the hotel. and really went after me with a peach tree switch. After that switching, I was not allowed to play outside for 3 days. Needless to say, as much as I love figs, I did not climb that tree again. I remember very well my first Christmas as a little boy. Frankie and Ruth and I all slept in one large room, each in our own bed. Ethel and David slept in another room across the hall from us. Our only light was a kerosene lamp and any light which came from the large fireplace in the room. Our stockings were hanging over the fireplace from the mantel, and you can be sure that we were in bed right after supper on this Christmas Eve. When Daddy wakened us early on Christmas morning, we went at once to our stockings. In my stocking was an orange, a tangerine, a bunch of raisins on the stem, some nigatoes, and walnuts, an apple, a pear, and a bag of pyramid chocolates. After we all had jumped up and down over our stockings, we were taken to the large dining room which served as a restaurant in normal times. Frankie, Ruth, Ethel, David, Mother and Daddy, Grandmother and Granddaddy Church, and me. The tree was all the way up to the ceiling, and on that tree were all kinds of ornaments. They were all homemade, I found out later in life. Of course, there were no electric lights, but there were little candle holders all over the tree with little white candles all lighted and sparkling oh so bright. We were not allowed to touch the tree, for I am sure now, if we did, we could cause a fire. Dad and Mother and our grandparents were drinking something out of a cup. Found out many years later that it was eggnog with lots of nog. Everyone got packages, the girls' dolls and doll carriages and other toys. I got a cowboy suit and a toy gun, a toy horse and a toy dog. Suddenly my daddy took me around to the back side of the tree and showed me the most beautiful automobile that I had ever seen. It was bright red and had a seat that I could sit in. It had electric lights and an electric horn, all run by small batteries. When you sat in the seat, you could put your feet on pedals and make the car go just as you do a bicycle today. Later I found out from Mother that Daddy had ordered that from one of the traveling men from New York who had sold him some general merchandise for his stores. It was the only one in our part of the country, and for many years after that, when we were grown, my dad and mother loved to tell the story of that little boy and his excitement at this first Christmas he could remember. On that particular Christmas Eve, it was sprinkling rain, and I did so want to take out that automobile and try it, but of course my father and mother would not permit me to do that. One of the nicest things I remember about my childhood in Clayton was having my half-sister Ethel recite poems for me. I remembered vividly a few lines of my favorite poem she used to recite, and I always asked her to repeat that poem to me when she would favor me with readings. For purposes of this recording, I was anxious to find the whole reading so you and your family could hear it. Since I remembered about the first 6 lines of the poem, about 4 lines in the middle, and the closing 4 or 5 lines, I did not know the title nor the author. I went to the library in downtown Cincinnati and inquired at the history desk if it were possible to find a poem if I knew the first few lines, even though I had not heard it since I was about 8 years old. When I told her that the first few lines were, "In a dark and dismal alley where the sunshine never came, dwelt a little lad named Tommy, sickly, delicate, and lame. The lady who waited on me picked up 5 books in which was contained titles, authors, and the first few lines of every poem or article which existed in the library. I went through the first 2 books, searching for the lines in a dark and dismal alley where the sunshine never came. No luck. The young lady looked through the first book remaining, and still no luck. She opened the second to last book, and a big smile came on her face. She had found the poem from the first few lines I had given to her. It was written in the 1860s by John F. McNichols, and its title is Tommy's Prayer. It is a very sad poem, but I'm recording it here and now for all of you to hear. Since I have gotten a copy, I can almost repeat it by heart, and it has brought back some beautiful memories of listening to Ethel recite it for me. Incidentally, Ethel knew it by heart and had recited it in her Sunday school class on one Sunday. I truly loved hearing it from her, and to tell the truth, it used to make me cry. Maybe someday you will take the time to listen to this recording. My family and friends, I hope. Sad though it may be, it represents the type of recitations which impressed me when I was growing up. And now for Tommy's Prayer. In a dark and dismal alley where the sunshine never came, dwelt a little lad named Tommy, sickly, delicate, and lame. He had never yet been healthy, but had lain since he was born, dragging out his weak existence, well nigh hopeless and forlorn. He was 6, was little Tommy. It was just 5 years ago, since his drunken mother dropped him and the babe was crippled so. He had never known the comfort of a mother's tender care, but her cruel blows and curses made his pain still worse to bear. There he lay within the cellar from the morning till the night, starved, neglected, cursed, ill-treated, naught to make his dull life bright. Not a single friend to love him, not a living thing to love, for he knew not of a Savior or a heaven up above. 'Twas a quiet summer evening, and the alley, too, was still. Tommy's little heart was sinking, and he felt so lonely, till floating up the quiet alley, wafted inwards from the street, came the sound of someone singing, singing oh so clear and sweet. Eagerly did Tommy listen as the singing nearer came. Oh, that he could see the singer, how he wished he wasn't lame. Then he called and shouted loudly till the singer heard the sound, and on noting whence it issued, soon the little cripple found. 'Twas a maiden, rough and rugged, hair unkempt and naked feet, all her garments torn and ragged, her appearance far from neat. "So you call me," said the maiden, "wonder what you want of me? Most folks call me Singing Jesse. What may your name chance to be?" "My name's Tommy. I'm a cripple, and I want to hear you sing, for it makes me feel so happy. Sing me something, sing anything." Jesse laughed and answered, smiling, "I can't stay here very long, but I'll sing a hymn to please you, what I calls a glory song." Then she sang to him of heaven, pearly grates and streets of gold, where the happy angel children are not starved or nipped with cold, but where happiness and gladness never can decrease or end, and where kind and loving Jesus is their sovereign and their friend. Oh, how Tommy's eyes did glisten as he drank in every word. As it fell from Singing Jesse, was it true what he had heard? And so anxiously he asked her, "Is there really such a place?" And a tear began to trickle down his pallid little face. "Tommy, you're a little heathen. Why, it's up beyond the sky. And if you will love the Savior, you shall go there when you die." Then said Tommy, "Tell me, Jesse, how can I the Savior love, when I'm down in this earth cellar, and he's up in heaven above?" So the little ragged maiden, who had heard at Sunday school all about the way to heaven and the Christian's golden rule, taught the little crippled Tommy how to love and how to pray. Then she sang a song of Jesus, kissed his cheek, and went away. Tommy lay within the cellar, which had grown so dark and cold, thinking all about the children and the streets of shining gold. And he heeded not the darkness of that damp and chilly room, for the joy in Tommy's bosom could disperse the deepest gloom. "Oh, if I could only see it," thought the cripple as he lay, Jesse said that Jesus listens, and I think I'll try and pray. So he put his hands together, and he closed his little eyes. And in accents weak, yet earnest, sent this message to the skies. Gentle Jesus, please forgive me, as I didn't know afore, that you're cared for little cripples who is weak and very poor. And I never heard of heaven till that Jesse came today and told me all about it. So I wants to try and pray. You can see me, can't you, Jesus? Jesse told me that you could. And I somehow must believe it, for it seems so prime and good. And she told me if I loved you, I should see you when I die, in the bright and happy heaven that is up beyond the sky. Lord, I'm only just a cripple, and I'm no use here below. For I heard my mother whisper she'd be glad if I could go. And I'm cold and hungry sometimes, and I feel so lonely too. Can't you take me, gentle Jesus, up to heaven along of you? Oh, I'd be so good and patient, and I'd never cry or fret. And your kindness to me, Jesus, I would surely not forget. I would love you all I know of and would never make a noise. Can't you find me just a corner where I'll watch the other boys? Oh, I think you'll do it, Jesus. Something tells me that you will. For I feel so glad and happy, and I do so want to go. How I long to see your Jesus and the children all so bright. Come and fetch me, won't you, Jesus? Come and fetch me home tonight. Tommy ceased his supplication. He had told his soul's desire, and he waited for the answer till his head began to tire. Then he turned towards his corner and lay huddled in a heap, closed his little eyes so gently, and was quickly fast asleep. Oh, I wish that every scoffer could have seen his little face as he lay there in the corner in that damp and noisome place. For his countenance was shining like an angel's, fair and bright, and it seemed to fill the cellar with a holy heavenly light. He had only heard of Jesus from a ragged singing girl. He might well have wondered, pondered, till his brain began to whirl. But he took it as she told it, and believed it then and there, simply trusting in the Savior and his kind and tender care. In the morning, when the mother came to wake her cripple boy, she discovered that his features wore a look of sweetest joy, and she shook him somewhat roughly. But the cripple's face was cold. He had gone to join the children in the streets of shining gold. Tommy's prayer had soon been answered, and the angel Death had come to remove him from his cellar to his bright and heavenly home, where sweet comfort, joy, and gladness never can decrease or end, and where Jesus reigns eternally, his sovereign and his friend. Another important memory which has stayed with me for lo these many years is the first visit back to Grandmother and Granddaddy Church in Clarksville, Georgia. Why I did not know about this earlier, I cannot say, but it seems that this trip was my first experience with an outside toilet. It was called privy in social circles, but plain folks called it an outhouse. This outside toilet was about 100 feet from the back porch, and the path you took to the area went along a fence on which was planted a grape arbor or vine. In addition, there were flowers such as honeysuckle and sweet shrubs along the fence on the way down. As I grew older, I was made aware that growing things were placed there purposely to assist in curtailing any odors which might waft upwards toward the house. My memory about the size of this outhouse is clear, as we used to visit our grandparents each year, but I am not certain when its size first dawned upon me as a youngster. There were 5 seats, so to speak, in the outhouse, 3 regular size for grown-ups and 2 little sizes for the children. I know, Gloria, that you must remember the first outhouse you saw when we took you to ride in Kentucky, and you had to use this type of toilet on one occasion. You were also fascinated with this type of relief station. I do remember that I used to go there every chance I would get, trying to figure out how the thing worked. Enough of this, as I want to get to the real important memory about my grandmother and her hidden goodies. As I have told you earlier in this recording, the house was quite large and rambled in many directions. There was a root cellar and a spring in the lower part of the lot. In the root cellar, grandmother kept potatoes and the most delicious June apples you could ever imagine. On the lot were apple trees, peach trees, and pear trees. In addition to these fruit trees, there was a vegetable garden, which of course everyone had back in those days. But back to the apples. Grandmother carried the key to the apple cellar on a string around her waist, and many times when I was not behaving too well or was fighting with my sisters, she would pat that key and say to me, "No apples or fruit, Sunny Moon, unless you settle down." That always kept me in line, for I did love those apples. I mentioned a spring, and I should have said spring house. The back of the lot slanted upward to a high hill out of which ran a stream of cold mountain water. The hill was clay, as most of Georgia's soil is in the northern part of the state, and there was built a spring house back into the hill and extending out to level ground, surrounded by a wooden structure with a door which could be locked. It was very cool in this spring house, and naturally this was where the eggs and milk and butter were stored in the warm weather. I still remember how good this cold spring water was during the hot summer months. Grandmother Church died when I was about 7 years old, and Granddaddy Church passed away when I was about 10 years. I can still hear him telling us that he did not get shot in the Civil War because he was so little he dodged the bullets. Incidentally, he served the full 4 years of the war between the states. He had a white goatee and was a very gentle man. Grandmother and Granddaddy Church are buried in Clarksville, Georgia, with several of their other children. My grandfather and grandmother Cannon are buried in the family cemetery on top of a hill about 200 yards from the location of their ancestral home. Their home was destroyed by General Sherman on his march through Georgia, but grandfather rebuilt it after the war. The grandfather of my children was born in Raleigh, Georgia, in the year of 1857, 4 years before the Civil War. Were he living today, this July the 15th, 1983, he would be 126 years old. Your grandmother Cannon was born in White County, Georgia, at the foot of Yona Mountain and near the little village of Cleveland, Georgia. She was born on June 15, 1876, and she passed away in her apartment in the Henry Grady Hotel in Atlanta, Georgia, in 1945. She was 70 years of age. Incidentally, your grandmother Cannon was 19 years younger than your grandfather. She was 26 years of age when they married, and Grandfather Cannon was 45 years of age. Both of your grandparents are buried in Westview Cemetery in Atlanta, Georgia, in the family plot. Now for another eventful happening in the life of Sunny Moon. My first day to attend school. The school in Clayton, Georgia, was about a mile and a half from the center of town, located on a large hill overlooking the valley surrounding Black Rock Mountain. I'll tell you more about this mountain later in this recording. The grade school and the high school were located in the same building, and the superintendent of the school was a man named Professor Thomas O'Kelly, a red-headed Irishman who loved children, but he was a strict disciplinarian. I remember that the time was in early September and was very warm. My main disgust was that Mother made me put on shoes and stockings on this first day of school. This early in the year was always too soon for me to cover my feet, so you can be certain that I did not wear shoes without a lot of objections. My pants were knee breeches, as there were no such thing as long pants for young boys till you reached at least 16 years of age in those days. I wore black long stockings. Frankie and Ruth had been going to school already for 2 or 3 years, so when we started out, I was walking between my sisters, holding hands with both of them. School in those days started at 8:30 a.m. and let out at 3:30 p.m. Mother had packed our lunch, as all parents did back then, and we would all eat together in the play yard at lunch recess. When recess came, I ate my lunch with Frankie and Ruth, but instead of going back to my classroom when the bell rang, I slipped out of the yard, took off my shoes and stockings, and ran the whole way back home to Mother. Apparently, I wanted no part of that school or those shoes and stockings either. When I got home to Mother, I remember that she told me that my sisters would be worrying about where I went. So she let me stay at home and sent George Ramsey back to the school to tell the teacher that I was at home and would be back in school the next day. I presume that my sisters were told about the situation. The next day, I begged Mother to let me leave off my shoes and stockings. I had seen other boys there barefooted. She consented to do this if I promised not to run off again. This made me very happy, so I did not have to wear shoes and stockings until I put them on for the winter. Two of my cousins started to school at the same time that I did, and after the first 3 or 4 days, school became a lot of fun. At about this time of my first year in school, my best friend was Benjamin Cannon, the son of my Uncle Charlie Cannon. Uncle Charlie had several children, including a daughter named Belle, a daughter named Aquila, and the youngest girl named Susie. They lived about a half mile from our home, and little Susie was about 4 years of age. This brings me to the first time I experienced any sadness in my life. How this catastrophe came about, I do not know. But apparently at about 4 o'clock in the morning in the months of November, the ground was snow-covered, their house caught fire in the room where the children slept. The fire was well along, and the bed where little Susie was sleeping was aflame, and Susie ran out the front door with her flannel nightgown in flames. Her father ran after her with a blanket, but before he could extinguish the fire, little Susie was burned beyond any chance of aid. I remember asking my mother why this happened to a little girl like Susie, as we all were so saddened by the ending of this little life. I remember the funeral in the Baptist church at the edge of Clayton. She was buried in the rear of that church. This was a sad, sad day for the citizens of Clayton, for Susie was a prime favorite of everyone. You must remember that Clayton was inhabited by about 400 people in the town proper, even though the county of Raven was heavily populated with farming families. Clayton, Georgia, was the county seat of Raven County, so it was naturally the business hub of that area. It was not unusual to see oxen-drawn wagons every Saturday in the town, many of which had started out early Friday morning in order to get to town by daybreak on Saturday. Whole families used to come to town 2 or 3 times a year, and on the way they had food and they rested in order to get their chores done before arriving in Clayton on Saturday morning. There were telephones in Clayton, but the only way most farming families could get a message to doctors in town was to go to a centrally located store or house of influence where a phone was available. Doctors back in those days drove for miles around the county in horse-drawn buggies and were able to keep in touch with their patients through periodic visits or through messengers dispatched to their home. I can remember one summer when I was 6 years of age of riding to Lakemont, Georgia with Dr. Dover, who had to deliver a baby. He had been summoned by the woman's husband, who had ridden on horseback to Clayton, a distance of 14 miles, to tell Dr. Dover his wife was about ready to deliver. He had a midwife near his home, but his wife had had some problems and wanted the doctor to deliver this baby, if at all possible. Dr. Dover came by the hotel, and Mother let me ride with him to Lakemont. Dr. Dover had a good carriage and 2 fast horses, but he used only 1 horse on this trip, and we arrived at the side of the Tallulah Falls River about 5 p.m. in the afternoon. It was summer and quite light. The husband had left a boat close to the bank, and Dr. Dover got into the boat and rowed himself across the river to the other side where his patient lived. I remember vividly that it began to get dark, and since things get spooky around a river at night, I began to get scared. I imagined I heard all sorts of things, such as wildcats, We had lots of them there, and other noises which got me more excited. I settled down in a blanket which I found in the buggy and covered my head. I guess I was really frightened. The next thing I knew, I was asleep and was being awakened by Dr. Dover. Later I found out that it was after 10 p.m., and was I glad to get back to the safety of my mother's arms. The last time I saw Dr. Dover was in 1936 when I went back to Clayton on a visit. I had lunch with Dr. Dover and his wife in Clayton, and he still remembered that little boy with his head covered up at the side of the Tallulah River at Lakemont, Georgia. Dr. Dover was in his 80s at that time and was still practicing medicine. Now, back to earlier days, Dr. Dover and Dr. James Green had the only drugstore in the county. It was called Dover and Green, naturally. They filled their own prescriptions and delivered them to their patients. It was the only place in Clayton where you could buy ice cream, and that was only on Sunday after church, and Monday and Tuesday or until the ice cream was gone. A man by the name of Bal Dawkins was a clerk in the drugstore, and the ice cream used to come to Clayton on Sunday morning by train. It came from Gainesville, Georgia, by Southern Railroad, and was transferred to the Tallulah Falls Road at Cornelia, Georgia, arriving in Clayton about 11:30 a.m. Sunday morning. I can still see Bal Dawkins going to the depot. Incidentally, a picture of this depot is hanging in my bedroom now, with his two big wheel carts to wait for the train to come in with the ice cream. There were two flavors, vanilla and chocolate. He got his cream and hurried back to the store as fast as he could. Already in front of his store, every person in town was waiting for ice cream. An ice cream cone was 2 cents, so with a nickel, Bal would give you 3 helpings. Boy, oh boy, what a treat. Now, I do not want to leave the impression that we did not have ice cream when I was a boy. We did have ice cream, but it was homemade ice cream, and that was nothing to compare with the store-bought stuff. I feel sure that a lot of this recording must be extremely boring. However, I'm rambling along because as things come to my mind, I feel that they might be of some interest to you. The first experience I had with a dentist was in Clayton, Georgia, when I was about 7 years old. You remember I mentioned a Mrs. Mac Junkin a few minutes ago, when I talked about climbing the fig tree. Well, Mrs. Mac Junkin was the wife of Dr. Mac Junkin, who was presumed to be a very fine dentist, but he was a big bull shooter, and along with being the town toper. About once every 6 months, Dr. Mac Junkin would get on a drunk, and he would be drunk 4, 5, 6 weeks. I don't know what happened to his dentistry business all during that time, but he'd finally come back to work and get all straightened out. I had a loose tooth that was bothering me, and it scared me to think of someone pulling it. So Dr. McJunkin saw me on the street one day, and he said, "You come on down to my office." His office, incidentally, was on the second floor over a hardware store. That store was owned by a man named Hamby, and I don't mind telling you that that hardware store building is still standing as I saw it about 5 years ago on a trip to Clayton. Dr. McJunkin took me up the steps on the side of the hardware store to his office. And when we got upstairs, he said to me, "Now, don't you worry, I'm not going to pull this tooth. You just let me put the string around it, and after I get the string around it, I'll let you pull it." And I looked at him, I guess, kind of queerly. He said, "Don't worry, Sonny Moon." So I let him put the string around my tooth. And about the time he finished getting that string around my tooth, he gave the string a jerk. Of course, my tooth came out, and I bled, and tears came to my eyes, but it didn't hurt too bad. So Dr. McJunkin gave me a sucker, and told me to go on about my business because the tooth didn't bleed any great length of time. Another activity which I remember very pleasantly is that I was allowed to take the cows to pastures with Uncle Charlie's children each morning. Belle, the older daughter, and Benjamin, the son who was my friend, would come by and get me, and I would go over to the pasture which was at the foot of Screamer Mountain. Uncle Charlie had a farm there, and he had a lot of pasture land. So we would take the cows out. He had about 7 or 8 cows, and we'd take them over to the pasture land, walk through the woods and enjoy the trees, and we'd have fun running and jumping and pretending that we were woodsmen and all the things that young boys do. Later on in the day, quite often I was allowed to go back with them and bring the cows back home for milking time. Of course, I was allowed to try to milk, but I never had much luck because I could not strip a cow. Young men and young boys today would not understand what stripping a cow means when you milk a cow. The stripping, or the last few drops in an udder, is the cream which makes up the richest part of the milk. But I was never strong enough or didn't have enough finesse to strip a cow properly, so they wouldn't let me do it. We had behind our house 4 cows, and it was David's chore to milk those cows. I loved to go with him because after he got through milking 3 and he got to the 4th one, he used to let me sit down on the ground beside the stool, and he would take that cow's teat and turn it up and squirt warm milk into my mouth. Of course, I got it all over my face, but it was delicious. How anybody could today drink warm milk and say it was delicious, I will never understand. But I can assure you I loved it at that time, and David enjoyed doing it with me. Sometime during my earlier days, I became very much interested in the writings of a man called Robert W. Service. I loved to commit his poems to memory, and I think that possibly you have remembered yourself on occasions when you would hear me say something about the cremation of Sam McGee. Since this is such an unusually attractive poem, I think maybe I might take the opportunity to repeat it for you here now. So here goes, The Cremation of Sam McGee. There are strange things done in the midnight sun by the men who moil for gold. The Arctic trails have their secret tales that would make your blood run cold. The northern lights have seen queer sights, but the queerest they ever did see was that night on the marge of Lake LaBarge. I cremated Sam McGee. Now, Sam McGee was from Tennessee, where the cotton blooms and blows. Why he left his home in the South to roam round the pole, God only knows. He was always cold, but the land of gold seemed to hold him like a spell. Though he'd often say in his homely way that he'd sooner live in hell. On a Christmas day, we were mushing our way over the Dawson Trail. Talk of your coal. Through the Parker's pole is stabbed like a driven nail. If our eyes we closed, then the lashes flows till sometimes we couldn't see. It wasn't much fun, but the only one to whimper was Sam McGee. And that very night, as we lay packed tight in our robes beneath the snow, and the dogs were fed, and the stars overhead were dancing heel and toe, he turned to me, and Cap, says he, I'll cash in this trip, I guess. And if I do, I'm asking that you won't refuse my last request. Well, he seemed so low that I couldn't say no. Then he says with a sort of moan, "It's the cursed cold, and it's got right hold till I'm chilled clean through to the bone. Yet 'tain't being dead, it's my awful dread of the icy grave that pains. So I want you to swear that foul or fair, you'll cremate my last remains." Now, a pal's last need is a thing to heed, so I swore I would not fail. And we started on at the streak of dawn, but God, he looked ghastly pale. He crouched on the sleigh, and he raved all day of his home in Tennessee. And before nightfall, a corpse was all that was left of Sam McGee. There wasn't a breath in that land of death, and I hurried, horror-driven, with a corpse half hid that I couldn't get rid because of a promise given. It was lashed to the sleigh, and it seemed to say, "You may tax your brawn and brains, but you promised true, and it's up to you to cremate those last remains." Now, a promise made is a debt unpaid, and the trail has its own stern code. In the days to come, though my lips were dumb, in my heart how I cursed that load. In the long, long night by the lone firelight, while the huskies round in a ring, howled out their woes to the homeless snows. Oh, God, how I loathe the thing. And every day that quiet clay seemed to heavy and heavier grow. And on I went, though the dogs were spent and the grub was getting low. The trail was bad, and I felt half mad, but I swore I would not give in. And I'd often sing to the hateful thing, and it hearkened with a grin. Till I came to the marge of Lake LaBarge, and a derelict there lay. It was jammed in the ice, but I saw in a trice it was called the Alice May. And I looked at it, and I thought a bit, and I looked at my frozen chum. "Then here," said I with a sudden cry, "is my crematorium." Some planks I tore from the cabin floor, and I lit the boiler fire. Some coal I found that was lying around, and I heaped the fuel higher. The flames just soared, and the furnace roared, such a blaze you seldom see. And I buried a hole in the glowing coal, and I stuffed in Sam McGee. Then I made a hike, for I didn't like to hear him sizzle so. And the heavens scowled, and the huskies howled, and the wind began to blow. It was icy cold, but the hot sweat rolled down my cheeks, and I don't know why. And the greasy smoke in an inky cloak went streaking down the sky. I do not know how long in the snow I wrestled with grisly fear. But the stars came out, and they danced about ere again I ventured near. I was sick with dread, but I bravely said, "I'll just take a peep inside. I guess he's cooked, and it's time I looked." Then the door I opened wide. And there sat Sam, looking cool and calm in the heart of the furnace roar. And he wore a smile you could see a mile, and he said, "Please close that door. It's fine in here, but I greatly fear you let in the cold and storm. Since I left Plumtree down in Tennessee, it's the first time I've been warm." There are strange things done in the midnight sun by the men who moil for gold. The Arctic trails have their secret tales that would make your blood run cold. The northern lights have seen queer sights, but the queerest they ever did see was that night on the marge of Lake LaBarge, I cremated Sam McGee.